Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from the UFO Congress at the Aquarius Casino Resort in Laughlin, Nevada, on the Colorado River. We have Ralph Ring with us, and Ralph, of course, if you looked at our website, we have a link over to Project Camelot, where you did an interview with our associate, Kerry Cassidy, and Bill Ryan, both of them, and you did something this morning here at the conference.
I did. I hope it went over good.
Well, it went over great. People were talking about you and your flying saucer machine, and we'll get right to that part of it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Tell us a little bit about that, what you talked about here this morning.
Well, I told them a little bit about me, backgrounds, so they'd get a handle on who I am.
I think it's a good format. We'll follow that.
Okay.
Who is Ralph Ring?
Well, I'm just a guy that was raised in the woods. Most of my life spent in the country, and my sister and I used to walk 7 miles round trip to a one-room schoolhouse up in Paradise, California, which is near Chico, California. And while I was doing that, I learned about natural law. Everything that we studied was telling us how things really worked. And one of which was an anthill that I pestered with a stick to get a rise out of them, and they stung me half to death. So I learned.
You know, you and I have a similar childhood experience. I set him one time trying to dig around on it, and that was not the thing to do.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You don't mess with Mother Nature.
Right.
I found that out. So it taught me a big lesson, and I learned to respect them, and I went back and apologized. And after that, I never had
literally apologized to the ants.
I literally apologized to the ants.
Well, see, you're a smarter guy than me. I didn't think about that.
Well, they must have heard me because I never got stung again after that. I eventually had deer that I could have eating out of my hand, and squirrels running all over my body looking for peanuts. And so I got familiar with the way, the rhythm of life. It's a natural flow. Mm-hmm. And it's quite different than the life I led later when I got into the military and out into to public domain. From there, let's see, I should have brought my notes.
That's okay. I'm sure it'll come to you. It's kind of like me. I started thinking about it. And you know, you mentioned the military.
I went into the military in 48. At Fort Ord, California. I was in the U.S. Army. I put in for engineering school.
In the 6th Army, huh?
No, it was the 3rd Infantry.
Okay, okay.
3rd, 7th, okay. Yeah. 3rd, 3rd Infantry. And they wanted to keep pushing me back in the infantry. And I kept putting in for engineering school, and it never worked. So they shipped me out to a little island in the Pacific called Guam, and we were there for a while until the Korean War thing came up. And in the middle of the night, they got us out of the sack and told us we're hitting the boats and we're going to make a Wonchon landing in North Korea, which we did. And it was I hate to say enlightening experience, although it was an experience I'll never forget. Because I got familiar with what killing was all about. I was in my outfit was the 3rd Division of the 7th Regimental Combat Team, which consisted of heavy machine guns, heavy mortars, 4.2 mortars, and 1.55 Hausers, big guns.
So when you were talking about a killing machine, you're not exaggerating?
No. No, and I got up, I was on the front line, we were the front line soldiers, we went out on patrols, and a lot of us got wiped out on the patrols, and I think I was one of 8 that was left out of 30 of us that were originally sent there, and I got wounded 4 times, I had frostbite in both feet and hands, and it was an experience that taught me what killing was about. And I had decided all the time I was there I would shoot when told to, But I seemed to miss my targets. I never hit a target. I would just seem to shoot up in the air or something. I don't know how that happened.
Right.
But I don't have any, I don't feel I've ever killed anybody in the military. And I know that doesn't sound very patriotic, but I was reinforcing our unit in other ways and reinforcing the whole platoon. I was a platoon leader at that time, and I made sure that everybody was doing their job. So anyway, I got out of there and came back and got discharged, and they were... I didn't know what to do. I said, well, I didn't get to engineering school. They taught me how to kill.
And they don't really apply for those jobs.
Nobody was hiring.
Yeah, right.
Nobody was hiring. But while I was on Guam, I got into skin diving. I used to go down to the beach, and I'd go underwater, and I got really familiar with nature and all the underwater life. So when I got back, I landed in San Francisco and started a skin diving business that went very well. Rapidly overnight, it progressed into become quite a business. And my relatives lived down in Newport Beach, California, which is down south by before
right. Know
San
where it
Diego.
Is? I used to do a show down there.
Oh, okay. Wow, you know where it is?
Yeah, right.
So I went down to join my.
I was actually on the border of Newport Beach and Costa Mesa, but I know where it is.
Okay. Well, my relatives had quite a bit to do with the real estate development in that area and so forth. And but I was on my own. I kind of...
Well, that's a good business to be in, especially back in those days.
Oh, yeah. They had the Irvine Coast Country Club. They had everything kind of in their pocket.
Uh-huh.
But from there, I met my wife, and we got married, and... got a little home in Costa Mesa, California, and had a couple of kids, and moved on. I continued my diving, but it progressively got to where I was staying out longer and diving deeper. And one time, a diving boat came up close to ours, and they were from U.S. Divers, the Jacques Cousteau U.S. Divers Corporation, and asked me, they'd heard about my diving experience and my research in the underwater technology, and they just flat asked me if I would like to become a part of their research and development department, which I accepted right away. I figured better pay and more security, and I could stay around the kids more. So I accepted the job. I got into my job, and we modified and changed many of the existing technologies, and then they came up with a mask, a wraparound mask that was my baby. I had to find a way to perfect this mask without distortion that would go down and withstand 200-300 foot depths so that you could see without distortion. So we went out for...
Sounds like you did pretty good with that, going to engineering school.
I seem to be progressing along. I don't know how I did it, but I did. And I was always inventing little things for them. How to control their products and their consumer goods and everything. And so they called me in one day, and they asked me if I would consider being a head diver on a Calypso 2 that they were going to put on the Pacific coast. The Calypso 1 was on the eastern coast.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, sure, when? They said, well, it'll be a year or two, but we'll keep you in mind. Well, the voyages out to Catalina Island and beyond were getting more and more extensive. The diving was getting deeper and deeper. I had a couple of close calls out there in diving. And my wife...
By close calls, you mean you went too deep or whatever? Or?
Well, I had forgotten. I thought my tank was full. I had good big tanks.
Well, that's something you wouldn't want to forget.
No. But I thought they were full because when I checked the gauges, they said full. But when I went down, over 250 feet, which requires a hangout on the way up so you can decompress. And I suddenly realized I was getting very low on air.
And you couldn't hang out much.
I couldn't hang out much, so I came up just exhaling.
They get you bins?
No, I never got them. Yeah, I was lucky enough to get up fast enough, and I got out of there. But when my wife heard about it, she said, no, that's it. The kids want a dad, and you need to be closer, and you're getting into too much danger. And I found an ad
here. In other words, the wife put the foot down.
She sure did. She stomped me. So she found an ad in a paper that was from Advanced Kinetics in Costa Mesa, California, that was advertising for a laboratory technician. And she said, why don't you go down and apply for that? And I said, well, I got no credential, no academic. I'm heavy weapons, man, and diving, that's all. And she said, no, you're tinkering, which I used to do 24/7 in the house. Mm-hmm. I was always tearing something apart. And my fundamental interest in life has been magnetics, magnetic power, and anything to do with magnetics. So she said, go down and put in an application. So I went down, and it was at lunchtime, and nobody was in the hostess and everything were out to lunch. I walked down the hall, and I went by the director's office. His name was Dr. Weinhardt. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking for a job. And he said, well, come in. They're out to lunch. Sit down. What's your credentials? I said, I learned how a bumblebee operates. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I was on the second floor of the science class at Santa Cruz High School when my physics teacher, he was teaching physics, was saying bumblebees don't aerodynamically, they can't fly. And at that moment, I looked out the window and there was a bumblebee hovering right, looking me square in the eye. And I had to make a decision to go back to my natural life, which was learning from nature, or listen to this guy that said it can't be done. There's no such thing. Well, later on, I found out both was true, that bumblebees technically don't fly, but bumblebees do levitate. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's because that's a question every high school science teacher it brings up.
Well, I learned it from Arthur Aho, who was a brother of Wayne Aho, who worked with us with Otis Carr in Apple Valley. And he wrote a book, Tomorrow's Energy Need Not Be Fuel. And in that book, he explains how bumblebees levitate. And there's a little hollow cavity next to their larynx that once they start the beat of their wings, they start increasing the frequency until they match the surrounding frequency, and in this case, the Earth's frequency at 8.5 cycles. And once they reach that frequency, this waves go back and forth in this cavity, and they resonate. And they reach what you could call a zero point. They nullify the gravity around them, and they create their own force field around them, and they become a free agent from gravity. And I later learned that hummingbirds and some lizards, there's a lot of animals that do this already. They actually operate on a different natural law than we talk about.
And I have a hunch this is going to come in handy later in your life.
Oh, yeah.
The reason I say that, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back and find out how we get to bumblebees to zero-point energy and going from point A to point B in nothing. Actually, nanoseconds, I guess.
Yep, nanoseconds.
We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away.
It happened almost 60 years ago, but the debate still rages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? The most concise and complete series ever broadcast on Roswell, direct from Roswell. New programs added weekly. Check it out on the UFO Files on JerryPippin.com.
It looks like looks like it's about 8 or 10 miles west.
We're here with Ralph Ring, and maybe, in fact, many of you have watched the video of Ralph and the interview that Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan did. So you have a general idea where we're going, but for me, this is very interesting. In fact, Ralph, I had not realized that's how the bumblebee did it.
Yeah, that's the way they do it.
Yeah. So we're going over the background of Ralph Ring so you can understand what we're going to be talking about here in a minute.
Well, it was my interest.
So did the guy give you a job?
Oh, yeah. I told him, I said, I learned most of my stuff from lizards and birds and bumblebees and stuff. And we talked for quite a while about natural law. And every conventional law that he brought up, I could counter with a natural law that would work, where his ideas were coming short of an operational completion. And one of which was live water coming down a hill from a mountain. Nature neanders it and refreshes it every 2 feet with nitrogen and oxygen. And when man transports water, he does it in a straight line down a viaduct, and it's all dead water. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. Life, fish don't even like it. They jump out of the water. They don't like that kind of water.
So they got to breathe.
Huh?
Fish have to breathe.
Yeah.
They can't do that with dead water.
And they need that nitrogen. They need uh-huh. the life forces. So anyway, he said, okay, I'll tell you what. I said, well, I haven't even filled out an application. He said, no, we'll do that later. Last week, my man working on magnetics happened to leave, and it's just coincidence that you showed up and your interest is in magnetics. I'm going to put you on the magnetic project. I'm to work tomorrow morning.
This must have been a dream for you, dream job offer.
Yeah, I thought, well, this is it. This is where I'm, going to feel pretty good. So they did. They gave me the job, and it was I had a workbench. And I had a giant oscilloscope with a high-speed Polaroid camera and a cathode ray tube that was firing electrons down through a magnetic field. And my job was to get from point A to point B without deflection. And so that's all you have to do. And I sat there day after day taking hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures of these silly electrons being deflected to either the positive mm-hmm. or the negative side of the magnet. So I was getting kind of bored because they were telling me to just keep giving it as much force as you can. You've got to get this going because we're working on a project for the government. This was a government-funded research laboratory doing very, very quiet work that the government wanted them to do. He said, use as much power as you want. Well, I took that into consideration. Then I looked over on the next bench, and they were working on levitation. They had these giant coils and, iron coil with mm-hmm. copper windings.
Right.
And they would levitate steel balls for about 8 minutes and burn up the coils because they they put too much power to them, and they just shorted out, and they didn't worry about it because they could go to supply and get another one. And these were about $400 a piece, and this was in about 55. That was
a lot of money, right?
But they said, "Don't worry about it. We've got plenty of money." So, I was curious about that, and I had, through my interest in nature, found many other ways to do things, and one of which was levitating, and one of which was getting things to work without force.
So you are you talking like the bumblebee example?
Example, yeah,
right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, something like that.
Where you don't have to propel the bumblebee through space; it just levitates on its own mm-hmm. frequencies. It creates its own frequency and resonates to its environment.
So, back in your mind, you were probably thinking, these guys are wasting a lot of time.
I did. I did indeed. So to make a long story short, I went home and tinkered around, and I built a miniature setup that I had at work. I had a cathode ray tube, and I took it out of an old TV and magnets, and The thing I did was what I learned from nature neandering the water down through a gorge mm-hmm. that I used to frequent when I was a kid. And all I did differently was pulse the signal. In other words, I allowed the electron to spiral. And
okay.
it spiraled from negative and positive, never touching each one, but it went all the way through to the target. The first time and every time thereafter, for about 20 or 30 more times, I never had any trouble. So I took pictures of that. I wrote up the experiment. And then I got on the levitation thing. I took a 15-inch woofer speaker and put it on the carpet in my living room floor. Attached an audio amplifier. Started increasing the acoustics, yeah. the sound okay. waves. And I finally wound up with a ping pong ball. And I went up to about 28,000 cycles and found that the ping pong ball would suspend itself in this 15-inch.
In other words, at a 28,000 cycle tone, the ping pong ball was levitated.
Right. I'm not sure of the exact frequency. It might have been 29, it might have been 27, but it was around there somewhere.
In that area.
And so, as usual, it was late, and my wife said, come to bed, and I left it overnight. When I woke up in the morning, it was still levitating.
So it's longer than the 8 minutes with the ball bearings
they
were doing.
Stayed right. there all night, no noise.
Right, right.
There wasn't any heat involved. There wasn't any of that. It was acoustical levitation, and I'd heard about the Tibetans using sound waves to raise rocks up the side of mountains and stuff. So it didn't sound impossible to me. It sounded very, very logical, or very possible anyway. So I wrote that experiment up, along with the other, took pictures, went into Dr. Weinhardt's office, and I was expecting a raise. I thought he'd give me a raise and a promotion and everything. I thought, I solved your problem here on both
yeah,
of these
right,
things.
Right.
And
I guess you didn't get a good reception because there was no need for more funding. Is that what we're getting to?
Well, well, he says I know what I didn't think you'd get there. He says I know it's that simple. I know what you're doing. He was a PhD. He was a very famous German scientist. He said, I know it's that simple, but this is a government-funded project, and they pay us to look for answers, not to find them. And that blew me completely out of the water. I just couldn't comprehend what he was saying. And he said, "Yep, that's the way it is. This is maybe down the line in 20, 30, 40 years, but he says this is not where we're at. I'm going to shred this, tell you to go back to work, and forget about this. Don't even talk about it. Just
wow."
So I was struck down to the ground. I couldn't believe that. I thought I was going to make my mark in life. You know.
Yeah, I mean, logic would tell you. Aha, I solved it.
Yeah.
But it was illogical because that's not what they were interested in.
No, and I explained to him, I said, now I just did this on my living room floor with about $50 worth of stuff. If we get those engineers in there to work on this and we get together, I think we can come up with some super stuff. And he said, nope, don't talk to them. I don't want you to do anything. So I went back to work. I worked 2 more weeks and I couldn't stand it. I quit. I couldn't take it anymore. That was the end of that. So I started talking to other people about my experience, and I ran into a guy that was part of a group called Understanding. It was originated by a person called Daniel Fry out of California. And they would meet weekly and brainstorm and work together trying to understand where we are in our technology, where we are in our psychology and everything else. And I was talking to this guy, and he said, well, you sound like a bunch of people that I meet with. Come on over and talk. I said, okay. So I went over there, and I started talking about levitating bees, and my dream in life is to get floating homes, that everybody has their own home. that is
off run, the ground.
Off the ground. Mm-hmm. It's run by magnetic power, which is so simple that they've overlooked it or they've concealed it, one of the two, because it's absolutely, utterly, the simplest thing in the world is levitation. But they, for some reason, aren't using it. Well, I found out later, and along with the backslash I got from Dr. Weinhardt, that they really don't want any technology that doesn't make money. So they said, well, we got another guy that's along in the same, on the same page as you. His name is Otis T. Carr. He's in Oklahoma. He's in Norman, Oklahoma right now, and he's having some problems because they don't want him to go any further. He was demonstrating, starting to demonstrate his crafts. He's building small circular foil craft, and he's in trouble. We're going to bring him out here to meet you, and then we're going to find a place for you guys to go ahead and develop this out here. We want to get this technology out. So they did. They invited him out. He brought his entourage with him. He had about eight his engineers and public relations. Wayne Aho was with him, Dennis Ripoldi, a lot of people that were in those days known. They aren't known now. They all came out, and they put us up at Lake Arrowhead in one of the cabins that one of the people had in the group and said, just hang out here for a while until we get you a place to work. Well, that's where we were, and we brainstormed night and day up there, and I got into some discussions with Mr. Carr that were phenomenal. They were just absolutely...
Otis later became your partner, right?
Yeah.
And he's passed away.
Yeah, he passed away.
Yeah. Okay, so you're up in this cabin all the time, brainstorming.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a relationship built up with him and the others.
Right, and we talked about natural law. Uh-huh. Everything that he had learned. He was a protege of Nikola Tesla. He worked with Tesla for 3 years. In Baltimore, Maryland, and Tesla had tried consistently after being working for Westinghouse and Edison companies to convince J.P. Morgan, who was the backer at that time, the funder at that time, that you don't need any wires to transmit electricity. We're living in a sea of electricity, and you don't need all these wires and telephone poles. And J.P. Morgan said, now, wait a minute, Tesla. You're interrupting the copper industry. You're interrupting the lumber industry. And what are you talking about? Well, he said, it's kind of like a free energy because you can put a pole on the ground 30 feet and up in the air 30 feet, and you can draw in enough electricity to run your whole household forever without any pollution, without any noise, and most of all, no meters. Well, J.P. Morgan didn't want to hear that. He said, no, this is a monetary system, and there's no money in it, and we're not going to do that, Tesla. So, and he had built one very functional laboratory in Colorado Springs, where he had already demonstrated this wireless transmission of electricity. He could light lights. 2 miles away and light them up and no noise, no pollution, etc. But
about what year was this?
I don't remember.
Probably
I don't remember.
Could be in the 30s or 40s.
I think it was earlier than that. Well, maybe the 30s, I think.
Yeah.
Probably. Well, anyway.
The point was, we've had this for a long time.
Yeah. And it kind of broke Tesla's heart because all he wanted to do was help mankind have a better life.
Right.
And when he met Carr immediately they came together as good friends, and Carr was a sponge. He loved science, and he got close to Tesla, and Tesla taught him everything he knew about natural law. and told Carr, I'm not going to be able to make it in my lifetime. People like Morgan are out there that don't want this to happen. So you take it in your lifetime and go with it and run with the ball and see if you can make a touchdown. And if you can't, pass it on. And if they can't, pass it on. But this has to be someday, because they're going to run into more trouble than they realize. They're chasing their tails, and they're going to destroy themselves. They're on a destructive course.
Well, you're certainly probably right on that. We're getting closer, aren't we?
Yeah, we're getting very close now. Well, yeah. The bees are leaving California.
So it's not long.
No. So anyway, it was passed on to Carr, and Carr went ahead and developed the technology to build spaceships. And when he was had trouble in Norman, Oklahoma, with bad press and everything, they said, let's get him out here, because they're going to shut him down. And he had many, many threats against his life and everything. So we got a call up at Lake Arrowhead.
Well, I certainly understand that, since I'm a native of Oklahoma. But you go ahead.
Oh, okay. All right. So they gave us a call and said, we got you a... Coincidentally, there's a giant laboratory facility complete with warehouses, workshop, machine shop, offices, and everything necessary for you guys to go to work. And we're given a carte blanche on it. They for some reason they built this for a company that declined to take it, and so we want to see this thing develop, so it's yours to put
up. Now, was this a private corporation or something sort of? I mean, it seemed that money didn't seem to be an object there.
Well, we were.
I mean, somebody was funding you guys, right? Or was it just kind of a club?
Oh, yeah, we were being funded here and there, but yeah. A lot of it was out of our own pocket.
Oh, okay.
We were trying to do the.
And then you not only had sweat equity, you had sweat investment.
Right. So, anyway, we started developing craft, and to make things a little shorter here, we developed small bench models that we were operating natural principles with, and one of which I was involved with. We had a bench model, and we had it attached to an audio amplifier similar to that I had. It's a little more fancy than the one I had, but the one I had on the 15-inch speaker that I levitated with. And it started vibrating this disc. It's a 3-foot disc. And I touched the outside of the disc, and it was solid aluminum. And I kept feeling the hum. The whole room seemed to kind of hum. And I kept touching it, and pretty soon it got soft like jello, and pretty soon I put my fingers in through the aluminum hull of this craft on this little ship. And Carr just winked at me. He said, nothing. You know, he... And we got into some pretty far-out conversations about what life is and everything. And he said, we're going to be doing the big craft pretty soon, and you have to get familiar with these laws and what they are. First, you have to realize that we're living in a world of illusion, that everything is energy, including you and me and the deep blue sea. It's all energy. And we perceive of it in nanoseconds. We produce it with our retinas and create what we want to create. We're all creators, and we create our environment. And I said, well, yeah, but... And he said, no, there's no buts involved here. This is the way it is. There's a realm beyond belief. He said, the realm of belief, if you believe something, you can be convinced not to believe it. And it's called the world of duality. You get into this is black, this is white, this is red, this is... And he says it goes on and on forever in a box. It's like you're chasing your tail in a box. And you don't really get anywhere.
Okay, so he was telling you something that just seems a little hard to comprehend. that nobody's real and everybody's real at the same time. We're all energy of some sort, and our retinas transpose it. Did I get it kind of right?
That's it.
Okay.
That's it, yeah.
Well, that is hard to take.
You got it. You got it. So anyway, he said, well, now we're going to try and introduce this to the public. We've got General Motors on the phone. They agreed to meet us down in Riverside, California, for a talk and a demonstration of what we'd like to present to them. And I went down with Mr. Carr and a couple of the engineers. And when we got there, they had their engineers there, and they were all set up ready to see what we had. And we told them we wanted to take their wheels that were vertical, that was having to put down a lot of pavement for them to transport people in order to get somewhere. And we wanted to take their wheel and turn it sideways and get it off the ground. That way we wouldn't destroy any more of the earth. We wouldn't have to put down concrete.
Right. No more juggles.
Yeah, right. So, and we gave him a small demonstration of levitation.
Uh-huh.
And we showed him it's quite simple. There's nothing to it. And we want to ask you guys if you will help us manufacture spaceships for everyone. And he said, are you serious? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you realize magnetic power? We explained it to him. No such thing as accidents. And that in the craft that we were...
How does that work?
Well, if you played with magnets at all, you know that if you turn them one way, they attract. If you turn them the other way, they repel. And that's the nature of magnetism. It has an attraction and a repelling forces to it. So in the case of spaceships... And this was before computers really got going. Now there's nothing to it. But if you get into a craft and you have a magnetic field that you're in, like a bubble of a bubble, you can't crash. You can't crash into anything. You can't crash into each other or anything else.
In other words, when it gets close, it repels it.
It repels it.
Okay.
And with the advent of computers now, which can think faster than the brain, it's absolutely perfect, because there are no accidents. Well, he said, do you realize what the insurance company is going to be saying about this? No more money for insurance. No more. No. You guys are going too far out, too soon. He said, maybe 100 years. He was telling us the same thing that I'd heard before.
Yes. So in many ways, these guys were protecting their turf.
Yeah.
But they're really guilty of some sort of manslaughter, if you stop and think about it. Look how many automobile accidents we've had all these years. You look at all of the danger we've done to the ecology by still staying with fossil fuels. It's criminal.
Yes. Yes.
I mean.
I never. I understand.
I understand they're talking about. That they're just looking after the economy and the way they're doing it. But that's not all. There's always unintended results and consequences, and the unintended consequences is that hundreds of thousands of people have died over the years needlessly.
Yes, yes. I never looked at... Thank you for that. I never really comprehended that till just now. But that's true. They are responsible for many, many things that didn't have to happen after we gave them the option of a better way, of an easier way.
Right.
Either easier way.
So, I mean, this is one of the reasons I wanted you on the show, is these things, not only are they just trying to take care of an older venture capital mechanism, a way of making money, but they're actually doing harm,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lots of harm.
Yes, yeah, they were. And they rounded off, after we talked to them, the engineers checked us out, checked all our specs.
No, they didn't say you're full of BS. I said this will probably work, but we don't want to do it.
He said that'll probably work, but yeah. We're not interested. And I'll tell you what, Mr. Carr, if you put them up, we'll shoot them down. That was the exact words this guy said. If you put them up, we're going to shoot them down. So we were stunned, and we didn't know what to say, you know, how to react to that. So Mr. Carr, he was a very humble gentleman, and he just said, well, you know, it's going to happen sooner or later, and the later it gets, the more trouble, the more chaos, the more harm is going to happen. And we could end all this right now if you'd let us proceed. And he didn't want to hear anymore, and he left the room. That was the end of that interview.
So you once again hit a blank wall.
Hit another blank wall. So Mr. Carr said, all right, boys, we're going to have to get a larger model. We had a 45-foot craft that we had just got operational, got everything ready to operate. And he said, what we'll do is get this thing operational, and we will then take it and show the public. We'll spot all over the place with this thing, and more. We were going to build more, and the public
right,
see what's
right.
Going.
In other words, bypass.
Yeah, bypass.
Yeah,
this system.
These people that were standing in your way.
Right. So we did. We hurried up then. We worked day and night, and we got this 45-foot craft ready to go, operational. But before we could do anything, Carr said, now, boys, it's time for the briefing. And this is where we're gonna go a little further out than you've ever been before, and I'll explain all to you about this part of natural law. And that is your where you're going to go, we've got a 65 mile range here in Victorville, and you're going to go down range about 10 miles. I'm going to have you get out and do some things, and then you're going to come back, and that's it. That's the end of the experiment. And we said, well, that sounds simple. That's pretty good. So he explained that there is a limit to the brain. Of the capacity of the brain ends at the end of the body. The body, the brain is a computer that takes care of what you call a body, your machine, your vessel.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it has no interest, doesn't want any interest, it doesn't even know it exists. So the things that are going to happen to you, or you're going to have to open your mind. You're going to have to get clear your brain of any thoughts, and just relax. And I'll guide you. I'll be in touch with you by, you know, I don't even know how we communicated, but I could hear Carr talking all the time. And we got on board. There was three of us.
Okay. Now, let's. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want you to describe the craft, and you were obviously at some sort of test range, kind of like an automobile test range or something, out in Victorville, up in the high desert in California.
Right.
And the object, I guess, was to use this new power, this new levitation, to go from one place to another.
Right.
Had you expected that it would be instantaneous by then?
No, I didn't know.
They hadn't told you that yet.
They didn't say anything.
Yeah, okay. We'll be right back with Ralph Ring. I'm Jerry Pippin. We're at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada.
The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers. UFO and alien disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at shopjerrypippin.com.
with Jerry Pippin. We left Ralph Ring for the break. You were getting ready to test this vehicle. What did it look like?
Well, it was a 45-foot diameter craft, aluminum. It was a beautiful-looking ship. There was no... if you've seen one flying saucer, you've seen them all. This one looked pretty close to what you've probably seen.
And a little flying saucer. The crew cab top or something?
Yeah, and I've got pictures that, well, in fact, Project Camelot ran a lot of the specs and a lot of the pictures.
Right, right. We have them on our... So people, but for the radio audience, I just want to go over it again a little bit. So how many people got into this craft?
Well, there were three of us. And we were seated around, almost centrally located in the center of the craft. And there was a giant steel ball, a crystal, a white, a clear crystal ball, sitting in what looked to be like a gyro telescope setting. And then up through the bottom of this was a bright, I believed it to be a laser. And Carr was coaching us all the time, and he said, "Okay, now here's what we're gonna do." And he fired this up, and it was the most beautiful colors I've ever seen. It went from infrared to ultraviolet, all the way around this thing in millions of degrees. I mean, you could count forever and never get to the end of the colors.
Did it make noise?
No noise.
Okay.
And he said, "We're going to an area about 10 miles downrange that has a frequency that you could equate to aquamarine. So we're concentrate on aquamarine, concentrate on what you're doing, and relax. Clear your mind. Don't
now. Now, when
of
you say I concentrate on aquamarine, you're talking about mentally think about that.
Yeah, mentally think about the color." Uh-huh. And keep your eye on the globe, and that's it. Just don't do anything else. Don't do anything else. Just sit there. So we did, and this globe started to pulsate, and it started to glow in aquamarine color. And
so none of the three of you were controlling anything. You were sitting here just thinking.
We were just beyond thinking. They told us don't think. They said just sit there and keep your mind clear.
Okay.
And you'll know what happens after it happens. So we did that, and what happened was this aquamarine globe kept getting brighter and brighter, and we didn't have any sensation of movement at all. And Carr was telling us, "Okay, now get out of the ship, and I want you to go down and pick up sticks and stones, put them in your pockets. Blah, blah, blah. Spend a little time looking around, get familiar with the territory, and then get back on board," which we did. We got back on board, and he said, "Okay."
Did you have any sensation when you went there?
No, none.
Just instantaneously, you were there?
Instantaneously.
Okay. I guess Carr told you were there. Or?
Well, this is it. He said, "Get back on board and sit down." Now, at that time, everything was kind of blanked out, and I didn't realize till after the experiment, I started connecting the dots of a lot of this, of what happened to me. But then he said, "Okay, now get out of the ship, come on into debriefing, and I'll tell you all about this." So we got out of the ship, and we said, "It didn't work, did it?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, you think so?" And I said, "Yeah, I know. We didn't go anywhere. We didn't feel anything."
Okay.
And he said, "Well, you've got witnesses here. They saw the thing levitate, and then it disappeared, and then it reappeared in about 5 seconds. I said, "Oh, well, nothing like that happened to us." And then the time that we spent, which in retrospect equated to about 15 minutes picking up sticks and stones, we'd forgotten about until he said, after we had said, you know, "We didn't go anywhere, we didn't do anything," he said, "Check your pockets." So we checked our pockets, and out comes these sticks and stones and everything else. And we were beyond, we didn't know how that happened.
Uh-huh.
We were completely out of it. And he said, your brain can only comprehend so much, and where you went was the mind. You went beyond time, you went beyond space. Time is a creation of a period that you put between the beginning and the end of something. But in real life, there is no time. It's all infinity. It goes from no beginning and no end.
The Alpha Omega.
Alpha Omega.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he explained all that to us. And he went on to say that you'll find out later in life, by continuing your research in natural law, that if you operate from the mind, not the brain, get beyond the thinking of this is right and this is wrong, this is good and this is bad, that everything is one. Everything is all, it's all good, all of it. It's only bad when you say it's bad. And it might be bad to one person, good to another. And you're going to get confused and like scrambled eggs. You're going to get all mixed up if you stay in that box. And the only way out of the box is to do what you did on board the ship. Just clear your mind and then get into the knowing of what you're doing, where you absolutely know what to do. So anyway, that's what the experiment was. That's what I've been doing ever since. We formulated a group now. We've got quite a little group going. And I guess I've been invited to quite a few places to speak about this. And my group is behind me. We've got about 12 people that are have a wide range of expertise. We've spotted some land near Prescott, Arizona, where we are feeling that we can build a big research and development laboratory and start replicating or start building spaceships again, and then presenting them this time in a different way where I don't feel...
What's your plan on presenting them this time?
Well, we're going to build enough of them, and we're going to, via the internet, via the computer, via the wide exposure that we have now that we didn't have then, we're going to broadcast them and continually broadcast them on any media that we can, and then expose them to the public like overnight. We'll just come in droves with our craft and let people know that they've always been here. You just haven't been able to see them because your capacity has been so involved with earning a living and so forth. You haven't raised your consciousness high enough to realize what reality is. And
So the practical applications of what you're doing will be what?
The practical applications of what we're doing?
Of building these spaceships. Right. I mean, are we going to replace buses, cars, and trains with them? Or?
Oh, yeah, we're going to have homes. Everybody will have their own home, complete with all self-sufficient.
So you're going back to your original dream,
right,
of levitating houses.
Right.
And you'll have the pole outside with the electricity.
Right.
So, all of this is part of this scheme.
Right. No moving parts, no maintenance, no pollution, and no wearing out. Nothing will wear out. It'll last for as long as you want it to. And then from small homes, we want to go to cities and start levitating cities and have the same thing in the cities. And then
now, what's the advantage of a levitating city?
Well,
obviously the energy situation.
If I want a private location in the Ozark somewhere, and I want to sit down over a lake and make that be my home for a while.
So you don't have to worry about ground.
You don't have to touch the ground. You can be 3 inches or 3 miles above the ground. It makes no difference wherever you want to sit. But then if you want to get, for some reason, involved with something that's in the cities, then you take your little home and fly it to the big home of the mother city, or the mother ship, if you will.
So in other words, it would be every man could have his own RV.
Absolutely. Totally.
Yeah, you could just, and it wouldn't be limited to something with wheels on it. We're listening to Ralph Ring, and we're broadcasting here from the UFO Congress. We only got about 4 or 5 minutes left. How do people find you, Ralph, and people listening? And what in the perfect world would you like to have happen?
Well, years ago when I talked about these things, of course, they thought...
And how many years ago did this happen, by the way?
Well, this happened in the late 50s and early 60s.
Okay.
And, of course, in those days, to talk about the things I'm talking about now, you run the risk of them showing up with white jackets and putting in a rubber room for a while and everything
else.
Yeah,
right.
But now people are more... they're more exposed to technology. They know things are going on that we're not exposed to. The military is far exceeded anything. They've got technology now that far exceeds anything that people realize. They have,
for instance.
Well, they have underground cities, Mount Weather, for instance, in near upper state New York. It's a complete... I have some friends that are in FEMA, and they've been there and told me it's a complete... It's a small country. They've got sidewalks, they've got schools, they've got parks, they've got artificial sunlight, they've got gardens. And yet the public is vaguely, if at all, aware that these things go on. And I've heard of several facilities like that.
Well, that took a lot of money to build. I wonder, I guess the black ops projects and budgets are even bigger than we think.
Oh, yeah, and we're paying for it all and not getting any of the benefits.
No, who's going to get to go to these underground cities and why?
Well, I just talked to a gentleman the other night at dinner that is a retired Air Force pilot that has a privileged... pass that if in the event anything of major catastrophe happens, they will fly him immediately to Mount Weather, and him along with some other VIPs.
So there is a group that's already made the decisions of who gets the benefits
goes,
and
right.
who gets stuck out here in the middle of
right.
whatever happens.
They're all VIPs for them on their side.
Yeah.
None of us.
Yeah, I don't have a pass, do you?
I don't have a pass.
Yeah.
No.
Well, it's too bad.
So, yeah, it is.
So basically, you may open this up down in Prescott, and when you do, we want to get back with you and find out what's happening.
Okay.
But your first project, what do you think it'll be? Is it going to be the housing developments or the vehicles themselves or the free electricity or...
Well, there's technology out now that is available in the way of solar panels and so forth that outdate the solar panels that have been used in the past. They've got they have developed now solar that can be put on your car or painted onto your house that will absorb electricity right out of the atmosphere, right from the sun and the atmosphere. And we want to start then on a low-key presenting alternative energies to people so that they can see that this is a real thing, and we will progress on towards our goal, which is with floating homes or spaceships, if you will. And that will come down the line.
Now, one final question before we go here. You keep using the term spaceship, and literally they travel in space. Mm-hmm. Will we be limited to earthbound vehicles, or can they use this for interstellar things, or do you have any idea?
Once the consciousness is raised of who and what we really are, we are living in a sea of illusion.
And I want to ask you, you're a realistic guy, and so am I.
Sure.
And we're not putting anybody down, but the world's got a lot of... I'm from Oklahoma, so I can use the term.
Okay.
Rednecks, there's a lot of that mentality around. How are they ever going to get up to this consciousness to use this?
Oh, they'll make it. They'll make it.
Okay.
I don't know how.
Yeah, and no other, you're optimistic. Anybody probably can use these these things once you develop it?
Well, right now they're doing more things right now than they realize. People right now are walking through walls. They're doing everything, but they don't realize what they're doing because they don't realize who and what they are. They're a tremendous power of energy. That's what they are, is a big ball of energy.
I don't remember walking through a wall. But
well.
But I'm not going to call you a liar because you seem to be a very intelligent human being. So
we had eight people in Prescott, Arizona, at a meeting, and I had all eight of them walk through the wall. So
you did.
Yeah. It's there's nothing to it. It's quite.
Well, we're going to have to make another appointment with either Carrie, okay, or we'll get our camera out and watch this.
Well,
yeah,
okay,
you can't do it,
okay.
Huh?
Well,
yeah. We'll be talking to you, Ralph. I've enjoyed it.
You have to be able to know what's happening.
Okay.
And it's etheric technology.
Good luck, and I think your heart's in the right place. And we're out of time, but it's been very, very interesting. And urge people to look at the Carrie Cassidy, Bill Ryan interview with Ralph Ring to fill this out a little bit. Roberta Scott has been our on-location producer. Our editor has been Jane Swartley. Until next time, cheers. This is Jerry Pippin. Good night.
I'm Jim Mars, author of Alien Agenda, the world's top-selling nonfiction book on UFOs. I'm here today to tell you one of the most fascinating stories I've come across in my career as a journalist. The secret of Reggate is that so many people in one small American community now know that there is so much more to the universe than what we see and experience in our everyday world.
Save $5 this month when you purchase The Secret of Reggate DVD from ShopJerryPippin.com. This film won the prestigious People's Choice Awards at the 2004 UFO Conference. The Secret of Reggate will astound you. You will want to see it again and again. Save $5. Order it now, this month only, at ShopJerryPippin.com. Secret of Reggate, a Linda Cowan production.